Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday morning. It is the 16th of September, and we thank you for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you all here. It is lots of fun. We welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. That's all you have to do. Panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce you to the panel this morning. Alan is off today for Yom Kippur, but we have three wonderful panelists, and we are excited to talk to them. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. So, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Akarias-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. The sun is back out, so I'm happy and ready to go.
Excellent. Yes, the sun will. The sun gives us a little boost, a little kick to say, yes, we can do this. Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association and a woman who I harangued just about 24 minutes ago to be on this program, Judy Patrick. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am super glad to be with you.
Did you have a good media project taping?
Oh, man, it's a good one this week. Some discussion about whether or not the government should help out media organizations that are struggling financially, you know, whether or not we should write editorials about whether or not that's a good idea. Good question.
Oh, that's really good stuff. Yeah, excellent. Yeah. Well, we look forward to hearing that on Sunday and Monday, of course. Albany's Chief City Auditor, Dorsey Appleers, joins us. Good morning, Dorsey. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning, Joe, Vera, Judy. So happy to be joining you this morning.
Great pleasure to have all of you with us this morning. We welcome everyone to write in if you wish, panel at WAMC.org. We won't get to everybody, but we'll try. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, let's get to one of the big stories, and this is interesting to me. I don't really get it, so let's try to figure it out. The U.S. booster policy is in flux as studies add to the question marks that are around this. And so we're trying to figure out what's right. And, you know, that can often be difficult to do in these times. I just realized that my computer went out, so I apologize for while I vamp here. But basically, hey, Judy, what's your login for the New York Times? hold on. I'll get there. Maybe I won't.
Well, we'll work on it.
Anyway, here we go. The U.S. booster shot campaign is in question as the FDA prepares for a key decision. This is something that has been made very, very confusing, I think. The president even acknowledged the confusion in a speech that he gave about a week and a half ago. The planned booster shot campaign in the United States is dividing experts as the FDA and their vaccine advisory committee prepares to meet Friday for a non-binding vote on whether the agency should approve a third dose of the vaccine developed by Pfizer. The Biden administration has come out in strong support of giving booster shots to most Americans, and some states have begun preparing to distribute them as soon as next week. Immunocompromised people have been authorized to get booster shots since August, and many people with healthy immune systems have not waited for FDA approval to get theirs. But the scientific community is split on this matter. Two senior outgoing FDA officials recently wrote a review with other scientists that was published in the Lancet Medical Journal, in which they argue that current vaccine supplies, this is a quote, current vaccine supplies could save more lives if used in previously unvaccinated populations than if used as boosters in vaccinated populations. The World Health Organization, for its part, has called for a moratorium on booster shots until the end of the year to ensure sufficient supply for poorer countries, a call that the White House has characterized as a, quote, fall choice. You will remember that earlier the president said that as of September 20th, which, checking in my calendar, is just 4 days away, that the Pfizer folks would start to get booster shots. They came out in strong support of giving booster shots to most Americans and began to prepare in the president's remarks last week, he said, for our part, the White House is ready to go. All right. It's all confusing. Judy, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a horrible communication from the federal government, especially the administration. Well, first, they're telling us we're going to do booster shots, and then they're, you know, it's on hold. I mean, we've known, I think, back since the spring, people were suggesting that there's likely going to be a need for booster shots at some point. So I think we've all thought that, but then there's been this series of events where, you know, the states are trying to prepare to give these booster shots, and then we're faced with a moral dilemma. Do we, you know, take care, do we give ourselves booster shots, or do we take care of the rest of the world? And it's a horrible moral dilemma for us. And in the meantime, some people are going out on their own and getting booster shots. They're getting a third. What's to prevent them from getting a fourth or a fifth? This is an issue where we do need a steady hand at the wheel, and we need a clear communication plan. The other thing that I'd like to, you know, we think of science as being exact, and they're going to come out with a definite recommendation one way or the other. But what I've learned over the last year and a half is that science isn't exact, and what they do is, you know, they're weighing risks and they're weighing all sorts of different variables, and oftentimes it's a judgment call. So I'm no expert. I'm not going to do my own research on this like so many anti-vaxxers are. I'm going to wait and see what the FDA, the CDC comes out with finally, and I just hope it's soon, and I just hope it's clear.
You know, the thing about this, Vera, that seemed to have just really added to the confusion is that when the White House came out and said that boosters were going to be necessary and that we would see them by by September 20th, and really, I think, made the case because there were so many breakthrough cases that this was something that was needed, implying that in many cases, those who had gotten the vaccine early, that it was wearing off. And at no time, it seemed that caught both the CDC and the FDA by surprise. They were fairly quick, not entirely quick, but fairly quick to come out and say, all right, well, we still have to look at this. We have to study this. We have to see it. But we'll probably reach the same conclusion. And then last week, the president said, well, we'll wait. We're ready to go. We'll wait for them to give the proper approvals. And when they're ready, we'll be ready. And now it seems like the FDA is saying, yeah, we're not even sure that we need them. That is a lot of confusion.
Well, I'm actually not that confused because I read a lot of information.
Well, then enlighten us, please. Thank you.
Because the issue is that the Biden administration has relied in particular on some Israeli studies.
Right.
And the Israelis have, you know, pursued booster shots for, you know, the population of Israel, not the West Bank. That's a different story.
Right.
Or the Palestinians outside of the state of Israel. But what they have found in their studies is that there were increasing numbers of breakthrough infections, and they went ahead with the booster Pfizer-BioNTech shots. And then they found that there was a significant reduction in these kinds of breakthrough infections. What they're basically reporting is that there are fewer breakthrough infections for people that received the booster shot, especially those with underlying conditions, and that's the data they have. The debate in this country is predominantly over how valuable these qualitative studies are in essence, because it's an observable bit of data, but we need to really study the effectiveness of booster shots over time. So it's not enough to say, oh, we have seen a significant, a part of the scientists are arguing it's not enough to know that the booster shots have helped in Israel for a particular population group for the past 3 weeks or month. A lot of scientists are arguing we need to wait more time to really evaluate the data that is coming in. So data is reliable, but you have to it changes over time because you collect more information and additional information, so it might change the information you have. And that's the internal debate, right? Because if we present it on a more global perspective, do not vaccinate the global population, what you have is the likelihood of new variants overtaking Delta and overtaking, becoming potentially more virulent or presenting new problems. And then whatever your booster shot is in the United States, it also will not help necessarily. Right?
So
that is the fear.
But that all makes sense. And I agree with everything you said, and that is scientific, and that all makes sense. But the confusing part, I think, is when you have the administration coming out and saying September 20th is the day, 8 months from 8 months from the time that you got your shot, we're going to get this done. We need to get you in. We're going to start in the same process. We're going to start with the older population, then we're going to move through. That's where the confusion came in.
Yeah, I think it makes perfect sense on Monday or whenever the Biden administration wants to announce it or affirm it, that people with underlying immunodeficiencies or those that underwent organ transplants or those that are experience certain types of cancers and medications and the elderly, they might want to go ahead because that seems to be the trend also coming from Israel. But to announce everyone should be having a booster shot might be a bit premature. So I think the Biden administration will likely find a middle way after various additional discussions tomorrow and, over the weekend. I think they will announce that anybody 65 and older and immunosuppressed will have access to boosters, is my guess.
So my only pushback to what you just said is that they already did that. Like, they already came out and said that everybody should get it. And I think that is what's confusing. Even to the scientists who were looking going, all right, well, we didn't say that. Well, where are we here?
Well, Judy's right. They messed up on that.
Okay. All right. Just want to make sure we're all on the same page. Dorsey, your thoughts.
So many thoughts here. And Joe, to your point about the confusion, I think that this goes back to the public's expectations when it comes to elected leaders, and especially at the top. And so what we're seeing when it comes to President Biden versus the prior administration is this stance to get out in front of this pandemic, to be decisive when it comes to making decisions, to put out clear messaging. The issue with that is, as Vera pointed out, when it comes to the science, either Vera or Judy made this point about the science, and sometimes it's not precise, it's not exact. And so there is some fluidity here. And so sometimes as members of the public, we want to know, it's not okay for an elected official to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And so here you have this struggle of coming out decisive based on, and while there may be some in the public health and science community who said, no, we didn't say this, but there have been guidance and messages delivered to the administration who have been saying, we will be ready. We're going to need this. This is who should be vaccinated. And it goes back to where we are at this moment when it comes to the FDA's meeting that will be happening tomorrow. It is okay to have a difference of opinion when it comes to the science and the research. And there should be differences of opinion. The other quick points that I'll make is that this is a pandemic that none of us have experienced in our lifetime, and so it's happening in real time. And while this is life-threatening in many cases, and people want answers right away, it's important for people to also understand that it takes time to conduct research studies, as Vera pointed out, to observe how the vaccine impacts different people. What are the short-term and long-term implications?
10 seconds.
And so, I'm sorry?
I said we just have 10 seconds, but go ahead. I'll let you finish your sentence, but then we have to break.
So I'll conclude with that point. You know, this is one of those things where you have to pay attention, but also have some patience and allow for
fluidity
and changes.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel this morning. Great group assembled. Dorsey Appliers, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Judy Patrick with us. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Judy, we've been talking about what the FDA will do, what the CDC thinks about this, the confusion. Meanwhile, we have this overriding raging debate all over our country about vaccines and mandates and masking and schools and .. and lawsuits and the like. This confusion, however easy it may be to bring back onto track, isn't helping matters any, is it?
No, it's adding fuel to the anti-vax fire, I think. It's just feeding into many of the people who aren't getting vaccinated, their belief that nobody know that, you know, that they can't trust what's happening. You know, we don't know, like, they're talking about boosters for people who got Pfizer, but not boosters for people who got Moderna or the Johnson & Johnson. It's, you know, you're getting these different messages, and it's not helping. And although it's good to know, we can't lose sight of the fact that every day more and more people get vaccinated. I think it's like 800,000 people day are getting their vaccines. I was getting my flu shot yesterday, and there were people in the pharmacy getting their COVID vaccine. I was almost tempted to say, what took you so long? But I was glad that they were there, you know. But, you know, slowly that's happening. You're going to have these pockets of resistance out there. But, you know, I was listening to Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York now, who is defending the legislation New York passed, which has been put on hold, which requires health workers to be vaccinated. The federal judge out in Utica has put a temporary restraining order on that. But she's saying, you know what, there shouldn't be a religious exemption. I was researching, you know, what religions actually people have moral objections to getting vaccinated. Even the Christian Scientists say that's a personal decision. We're not dogmatic about this. We believe in public health. So even if you're a Christian Scientist, you can get a vaccine. So
yes.
This is all over the place. And I'd hoped at this point in this pandemic, it'd be a lot more rational out there, but it seems like it's getting worse.
Realizing the porous nature of my brain, I had written down as we were leaving the last segment to immediately go back to Dorsey to return to her point, because I had to unfortunately cut her off for the news, and then I immediately forgot that. So Dorsey, we'll go back to you as you were making some very good points about this of adding to the confusion and what municipalities now need to do to figure this out.
Thanks, Joe. And it is okay. You'll learn not to put me before a break, because I can just go and go and go.
I would, if it were up to me and we didn't have underwriting, I would have blown through the British people. But go ahead.
So I think one of the points that I was trying to make before the break was just acknowledging that there's fluidity here, and then there's multiple stakeholders involved in this. You have politicians, you have researchers / public health folks, you have private industry, you have the public, and everybody has their role to play. And what it appears is that President Biden, coming out the way he has, is he's playing his role as a politician to say, look, I can't control the science, But what I can help to lead, take the lead on is the rollout and implementation. And we are ready to go, but we're waiting for the green light. Was he wrong with coming out with dates and being that specific? I think that, to your point about confusion, when you give people dates and those that level of detail, people hold you to that.
Sure.
And so I think that was a misstep. Vera talked about the study, the Israeli study, and in addition to the time, there hasn't been a lot of time to observe how the vaccine, the booster, is impacting their population. But in addition, as we learn about the limitations to research, there are limitations when it comes to the demographics of a population. So what happened, what's happening as the booster is working its way through people's system in Israel, that may look very different on a U.S. population. And so we also have to be conscious about the populations when the populations look different. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to conclude with that point. And then on the topic of the anti-vaxxers, honestly, I don't think there's anything that can be done to change some of the anti-vaxxers' minds when it comes to the mask. So some may say, oh, this confusion is fueling that. I don't think so. I think people have made up in their mind they don't want to wear masks for a variety of reasons, and no matter what is going on, there's going to be a problem, and they're not going to want to wear masks.
So, Vera, please let us know, as our comparative politics expert, you mentioned Israel, of course. I've been reading stories about what they've been doing in the UK, where boosters have been approved and they are moving ahead with those boosters. So when you look around the rest of the world and compare us to them in dealing with this pandemic, and I know we're all over the map, but how does it look?
So I think one point I wanted to make was that in the United States, we often dislike studies that are carried out in other countries.
Yeah.
So it's happened to me multiple times where, for example, in my own health situation, I brought studies from Israel or from Europe to my physicians, and I said, this is what's done in other countries. And they said, well, but here the FDA hasn't approved it yet. So we have a very strict system in place in this country, and that is also one of the debate issues that are emerging. And general immunization rates are going up faster in Europe now in comparison to the United States. So there's more, you know, a slower start, but now catching up. And you know, the boosters are not really a big topic in most countries in Europe. The idea is to get everybody the second shot, except for the UK. Boosters are in conversation. Here in the United States, we've had a soft opening to boosters. And people, so when Judy says, you know, she was surprised to see people get, or maybe, I don't know if she, Judy, you said you were surprised or not about people getting their shots now. It might actually be that they're getting their booster shot, because that is available and has been for weeks at pharmacies for people with immunosuppressant medications and organ transplants and so on. So there has been a soft opening in this country anyways for boosters for certain populations,
right,
except for the hard opening. You know, was supposed to happen on Monday.
Yeah.
So the approaches are different. There's a lot more conversation in Europe, in Canada, about general access to immunization across the world. Because the fear is that even if we get things more under control here in North America and in Europe, what will happen is that variants emerge if we don't take care of everyone. And that is the fundamental issue that is facing us. Can we pretend that we're addressing public health appropriately if we only think domestically? And I think that is something I would generally challenge. And sometimes we're slow in this country looking at studies from other countries in addition to our own studies.
You mentioned Canada, but Canada was quick to say, so you have this order from the president to require vaccines for federal employees and some companies, but doesn't extend to those traveling by air or train. And people are wondering why not, and especially since Canada and other countries do that. And so it's another one of those things of like, oh, okay, did we just not check that off the list, or is there just so much stuff that it takes a while for it all to settle?
I think, as always, economic interests interfere with scientific data.
That was a very diplomatic way of putting that, I think. Let's take a break.
I learned from Dorsey.
When we take, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We have many letters. We'll go to those, and we'll continue on this subject, and then we'll move on to other stuff in our 10 o'clock hour. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will be right back after this. I want to go to letters. I was just thinking what Vera said just before the break about, you know, the interest, the business interests, of course, that come into this. But, you know, you look at science. So we're looking at the manufacturers of the vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna and J&J. And, you know, they're adding to the chorus of saying, yeah, you probably do need. Our science says that after 8-12 months, you lose 40% of the shot. So, you know, again, that's one of those things like, well, yes, they want to sell more shots. Got it. But that's their science, too, and something else to throw into the mix. We go to Tracy. I remember Alan saying he had received a booster already, so I assume many others have had them as well. Any of the confusion that Joe mentions about the safety and efficacy, or just the rollout? No, I think the confusion was the rollout, was the fact that they gave a date and said 8 months, and they were very specific as to how people get when people should get shots, especially for Pfizer recipients. And then the FDA and the CDC said not so fast, and they said, the president just last week said, okay, well, we'll wait for that, but we're ready to go, and we have it in place. The states are ready to go, and we're waiting. So that's what I meant by the confusion. Sean writes to us and says, understand that when you speak of religious exemption, it doesn't matter what leaders say. They are men and women, and a true religious feeling is between an individual and their higher power. Questioning that will be a slippery slope.
Well, except for maybe I can say that if the information that the religious exemption is based on is factually incorrect, that would be a problem. Religious feeling, if it's not based on factual evidence, you can have that feeling, but it can determine public health decisions.
But it's a really good point. If you remember, you used to have to be a minister to perform or a public official to perform right. Wedding ceremonies. But now anybody can join this an online church and become, you know, a minister
ordained,
able to perform weddings. And so what is religion is anything anybody can define it. The question is whether or not the courts will say it has to be part of an organized religion.
You forgot ship captain. Ship captains could also, yes. But you're right. Yeah, no, and everyone can do it. And it does muddy the waters. It makes it very difficult. Let's see. Jane writes, I agree with the panelists to say that the confusion is understandable given the different studies that have come out and the different opinions that people have as more information comes in. However, it's also crucial to remember that there are many countries that haven't had any inoculations yet. Mm-hmm. And here we are with people who are protected, wanting to get even more protected. It is at the expense of those countries getting the help from us to get the first vaccinations to their people. I wonder if we really would send more vaccinations to other countries if we hold off on the boosters here. If that is true, it is important to stress that issue and the importance that it deserves.
Well, on another point, there isn't really a limited ability to produce vaccination either, except for profit-making operations where we, don't share the information with countries to produce those vaccines themselves. So there is a capitalist element to the shortage of vaccines.
And the shortage, from my understanding, Vera, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that yes, there is, certainly is a shortage in many countries, but a lot of it has to do with distribution, right? I mean, there's vaccine out there, enough vaccine out there for a lot of people, but it's getting it to where it needs to go, right?
Yes, because you have to pay for it. And there are many countries that don't have the public health budgets to purchase and distribute and administer and collect data on what happens. So that is one of the fundamental barriers in many places.
Anne writes,
Go ahead, Dorsey.
Yes.
And I would echo that sentiment that, you know, many of the countries where we see a lag in vaccine rates is due to the capacity of their public health system or lack thereof. And as we saw with our own public health system here in this country, when the pandemic hit, we questioned our own public health system. Right. And so if you think of some countries that really don't have the resources, the capacity, they're struggling to make sure that they're keeping their public safe. But resources is a fundamental issue, and not just financial resources, but human resources.
Let's go to Anne, who writes, the primary problem with messaging is the confusion on the part of the public and perhaps public officials about how science generally works. We're all anxiously reading the results of this new study or that, and people lose faith in science when one study contradicts the last. Science does not rest on one study. Studies are assessed cumulatively over time, and a single study, even if it has tens of thousands of subjects, is never the last word. Since this is an emergency, the media reporting and the public are consuming these single study results, and the anti-science contingent uses this as a weapon to prove that the science is useless. Perhaps every article about a single study should include a paragraph about this.
Yeah, that's a great letter. I often have been tempted to put on social media anybody who tells me they're going to do their own research about whether or not to get a vaccine to tell me what they got on their high school biology regents exam. Did they pass? How'd they do?
You want to see transcripts, damn it. Keith writes, the main goal has always been herd immunity because it will limit the outbreaks and protect the most people possible, including the medically fragile. A small percentage of fully vaccinated people will get sick, but they will be able to stay out of the hospital and will survive. As a person with a compromised immune system and who has their booster shot, the last thing I wanted to do was to get another vaccine and trigger my immune system. It causes me all sorts of secondary problems, but I can't trust these selfish anti-vaxxers to do the right thing. Mark writes, please, everyone remember that the disease is brand new. The kind of progress and decisions that have happened in the last year unprecedented. Science is evolutionary, and the application of science to a medical decision is always subjective. Every human is different, and 1 + 1 does not always equal 2 in treatment options. I'm okay waiting for proper research. I'm okay for waiting for proper research, too. Goodness knows, I am all for waiting for a consensus and a bunch of very smart people coming together and saying, yes, this is what you need. This has been looked over by the FDA, and this has been looked over by the CDC, and this has been looked over by the President's Task Force, and this is how we feel. We have been in concert and conversation with other countries. This is how they're dealing with it. I'm fine with waiting as long as that takes. Where my issue is that all seemed to get, like, we had a study that came out of, as Vera mentioned, came out of Israel, and then all of a sudden the administration put in a time frame. And I think that was where the confusion came in, because that was when people started to say, oh, okay, I need a booster because it's wearing off. We're seeing all these breakthrough cases. And so nothing against science on that. It just, it seemed to be very confusing when that was made, and then they started to pull back on it, and now we're waiting for this decision tomorrow, and, you know, with some question as to whether they're going to say, yeah, maybe you can just hold off for a while.
But, Joe, you know, I think we also have to be conscious of the fact that we were seeing an increase due to the Delta variant also. So there were public health professionals coming out saying, given what has been said, that if you receive a vaccine, that over time, the effectiveness of that vaccine may change. And what we're seeing with the Delta variant is that even people who have been vaccinated are being exposed to the variant. Some are being hospitalized. And so there was this push,
yes,
to get the booster out. And I think, to your point about, again, going back to Biden's very specific commentary, being that specific was an issue. But there were a lot of elements at play that pushed the administration, the pressure, to come out to say, we have to get these boosters out before, to avoid another catastrophe, as we've seen in the past, and not in the present, we're still in it,
sure,
when it comes to this pandemic.
But it's a political perception problem for Biden, because he promised us he would follow the science. And when he made that announcement that the boosters would start to be available on September 20th, it seems like he was not following the science, or he was getting ahead of the science, even though it seems like there are very good reasons and the science was headed that way. He did promise us he would follow the science.
Didn't you assume, and maybe silly me, but I thought that when you make a proclamation like that, especially coming from this president, that, well, maybe he conferred with the FDA and the CDC.
Exactly.
I thought maybe they had talked.
Hmm? Well, I'm sure maybe he did confer with them, but maybe with some, mm-hmm, only.
Only the people that agreed with him. Yeah.
I was going to say the same thing. I'm sure there was some conversation that led him to believe, okay, we're going to do this, and this is when we're going to do it. But I think to the point about this administration saying we're going to follow the science, we're going to listen, one of the initial letters that you read, Joe, was, and you laid it out, the Biden administration comes out and says this. The FDA and CDC come out and say, oh, no, we're not ready.
Right.
And then the Biden administration corrects itself and says, okay, we're ready to go, but clearly the research, the scientists, we're not ready in that regard, so we're going to hold tight until we get additional guidance. To me, that is the administration's way of being responsive to say, we made a mistake when it comes to give the date. We're waiting, and we're going to wait, versus this is the date, and no matter what, putting pressure on the scientific community to push something, even when the scientific community is saying, we're not there, we're not ready. So I think also just looking at what we've come out of, we're even seeing a difference when it comes to who the messaging, because it's allowing the scientific community to have voice to say, no, we're not ready. Mm. And we didn't see that under the Trump administration.
No. Dorsia Poyers is with us this morning, along with Vera Karius-Kelly and Judy Patrick, making up our panel. We'll continue our conversation, and we'll move on to other subjects as well when we come back. First, we have some messages, and then news with Ray Graff. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, a great group assembled, Dorsia Poyers, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Judy Patrick. Ellen is out today for Yom Kippur. We'll be back with us tomorrow. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go back to a few letters, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Mark writes, please everyone remember that the disease is brand new. Did I read this?
I think so, maybe.
The kind of progress and decisions that have happened in the last year. Yeah, I did read that. Okay, thank you.
Yep. A very good letter, though.
Yeah, so certainly worthy of being read again. Let's see. While I understand that we should be giving vaccines to other countries, writes John, isn't part of the problem the fact that the U.S. already has vaccines in stockpile? I remember early on in vaccine distribution all of the concern about being able to store the vaccines properly. If we don't have a mechanism to distribute vaccines in other countries before they go bad, should we use what we have first? That is a question from John. Christopher, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting question and worthwhile asking. Biden has released vast amounts of vaccine when they were, you know, close to expiring to be shared early on, especially with Canada and Mexico. And if you remember, we had vast numbers of AstraZeneca vaccine that we never used in this country, and that was shared with other countries too.
We got a letter from a listener saying, do you know that Dorsey has a Doctor of Public Health degree? I did not know that. Is that true, Dorsey?
Yes, that is correct.
All right, so why aren't you leading this entire conversation?
Yes, Dorsey. We put Dorsey in charge.
I was waiting. I was like, so how did you become an auditor?
That's a long story for another segment.
Okay. All right. But we have to keep that in mind. It takes our listeners to put us on the straight track. I had no idea that you had a public health degree. So, So when you look at this globally, I mean, I don't mean like globally, but like sort of look at the bigger picture of what we're all dealing with right now. I mean, we've never seen anything like this. I think you mentioned that before. And yet, is it a false impression that I have, or that we just don't seem to be up to the task? It just seems to be that for whatever planning there was around, nobody was expecting anything like this.
Yeah, you know, we have no choice but to be up to the task. And although we have not seen this particular pandemic, if you look back in our public health history, we've gone through as a nation public health pandemics before. And so we can glean from those experiences. I'm sure during those times there was confusion. Some of the same dynamics that are playing out now played out then. So we have no choice but to figure it out. And I think it is being honest and transparent about the various roles that we all play, and allowing the public health community, our researchers, scientists, giving them the space to do what they need to do to help all of us address this particular pandemic. And it's not just giving the space, but giving the resources so that we can conduct the necessary research.
Christopher writes to us and says real help for countries that need vaccines would involve suspending the patent for the vaccines we have and allowing broad production of all four versions at any facility across the globe capable of manufacturing them without litigation or interference from the U.S., the WTO, or any other body. Vaccines 2 months from expiring stuck in a freezer in Bloomington, Indiana, are logistically and practically useless for countries that need vaccines now. Discussing us or them in this context is a waste of time. Does anyone have any thoughts? I'm assuming Christopher knows what he's talking about, but I don't.
So, you know, I mean, in essence, there have been changes to at what temperature certain vaccines have to be stored, how long they can be stored, and also some medications don't have, you know, that's why, for example, you know, certain vaccines are shared. So, I mean, clearly there are ways to develop regimes to share more vaccines, but in essence, it is about patent conversations and financial interests, and the United States gained early on access through BioNTech, which was the, you know, one of the labs that early on developed the vaccine. And, you know, there are certain price negotiations that went on, which allowed the United States to start earlier on the purchases. So, I mean, these are very complex issues in terms of distribution and storage and economic capacity of certain countries, and then, of course, long-term interests in terms of earning from all your innovation and development of vaccines. So these are not easily answered, but I think the writer has raised some really important points.
Christopher, thank you very much for the letter. We go to Brenda. We don't all think science is exact. I'm not confused. As more studies are done, we'll get more information. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, let's move on to other topics if we can. And again, we welcome your letters. So yesterday, and we didn't talk about this because it was happening as we were on the air, but the many members of the women's gymnastics team testified yesterday and basically ripped into the FBI for botching the case against Larry Nassar, who sexually abused hundreds of women and girls. Ultimately, the FBI director Christopher Wray apologized for inexcusable failures in the investigation. Sitting at a witness table alongside three of her former gymnastics teammates, Simone Biles broke down in tears while explaining to a Senate committee that she doesn't want any more young people to experience the kind of suffering she endured at the hands of Lawrence Nassar, the former national team doctor. To be clear, I blame Larry Nassar, but I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated this abuse, said Ms. Biles, who is 24 years old. She said this as her mother, Nellie Biles, sat nearby, dabbing her eyes with a tissue. Ms. Biles and hundreds of other girls and women, including a majority of the members of the 2012 and 2016 U.S. Olympic women's gymnastic teams, were molested by Mr. Nassar, who is now serving what amounts to life in prison for multiple sex crimes. His serial molestation is at the center of one of the biggest child sex abuse cases in American history. Michaela Maroney, an Olympian in 2012, also testified, describing in detail how Mr. Nassar repeatedly abused her, even at the London Games, where she won a gold medal. She said she survived a harrowing ordeal when she and Mr. Nassar were at a competition in Tokyo, certain she was going to die that night because there was no way that he was going to let me go. Not only did the FBI not report my abuse, but when they eventually documented my report 17 months later, they made entirely false claims about what I had said, Ms. Maroney testified. They chose to lie about what I said and protect a serial child molester rather than protect not only me, but countless others. In a remarkable turn, the FBI Director Christopher Wray acknowledged the agency's mishandling of the case and apologized to the victims. Judy, how does that happen under the FBI's watch of just such a horrendous and what I would think, you know, basically an open secret amongst the Olympic community?
Right, and we should note that it was journalism that eventually brought this to light and made it stop like it should have years before. And one of the things I took away from yesterday was the idea that the FBI agent who initially handled this, he just got fired last week.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to shoot from the hip and not know all the information. Maybe there was a procedure they had to follow. But this person has been in the employ of the FBI all this time. Nassar was convicted, what was it, last year or the year before? Why has it taken so long for the FBI to deal with this? And then the supervisor of the FBI was able to retire. The gymnasts now are asking, they want a little bit more justice, and they would like to see these people criminally charged. The Justice Department officials weren't at the hearing yesterday, and you could hear the gymnast say, why aren't they here? They will be at a later hearing, I guess later this month. But those are, you know, serious questions. I think that we did a huge disservice to those young women. I mean, we're talking about girls. There were young women, but there were girls. They're 12 or 13 years old who were abused by this man. It's a horrible, horrible nightmare, and I am shocked. It's not that it never happens, because I have seen it in my life. Local police departments, they for many years they didn't know how to handle these kinds of cases. They would say, "Oh, it's not that bad." You heard one of the gymnasts say that yesterday. She was told, "Oh, is it really that bad?" Well, women or assault victims have gotten this for decades. People. The situation has improved, but I would have thought in 2021 we would be past this by now, but we're still dealing with these issues.
You know, I remember just a few years ago, Ali Raisman, who is an Olympic gymnast and was testified yesterday as well. She was at University at Albany speaking, and was speaking to a group of young gymnasts and my kids. I think my niece was one of the kids there, and she was I think 12 or 13 at the time. And somebody asked the question of, you know, did nobody know what was going on? And Ali Raisman looked at the kids and she said, you know, I think even you guys know that others should find it odd that an adult man wants to spend his non-working time with children. And that just really struck me, that there's a culture there, and that nobody saw it, and even if they did, no attention was paid to it. And certainly, and I thought back of that yesterday as I was hearing these accounts of, yes, you go and even with the FBI involved, they don't do anything about it. Vera?
To me, what, you know, of course I agree with what Judy said and what you just, you know, conveyed. What stood out to me, in addition to all the testimony, was, you know, the fact that so Christopher Wray, head of the FBI, apologizes,
yeah,
which is, you know, a thoughtful gesture. But what's more important to me is to figure out how this all happened.
Exactly.
And how the FBI allowed these agents to operate this way. To lie about what was said, to not file reports, to then retire. What is the training like for FBI agents? Why are they, apparently, from what we know, so callous and dismissive of young women's testimony? What is going on there that is fundamentally important to figure out? So an apology is a starting point, but not an end point. And I think it's very important for us to figure out what went wrong within the FBI organization. We have certain ideas of what's wrong. Young women perhaps not being taken seriously, or perceived as, you know, overly emotional, or not responding well to the stress of competing on the international level, whatever those kinds of frames are that are used to portray young women as not believable, that needs to be investigated, and the training for FBI agents needs to be adjusted. And maybe we need to figure out a better way of training agents and holding them responsible for when they make fundamental, horrific mistakes like these that led to hundreds of additional girls being abused. I mean,
yeah.
It is shocking to the core. So that is what the questions are. We need to investigate what went wrong and how it went wrong and how we can change the fundamental principles that obviously are in place at the FBI to this day.
It strikes me, too, that, you know, Simone Biles was testifying, and you have to do a mental note, because she has been in the public eye for so long, she's still only 23 years old. And in some cases, when this abuse happened, 12, 13 years old. That is, I mean, in any age, what happened to them is atrocious. But to put girls in that situation is also just a horrible crime. And you know, I think, yes, the FBI, but I think the whole system has to be looked at to figure out how, why they are so vulnerable to just this, you know, for one, well, I don't know that there is a better term than monster. Dorsey.
Yeah, I'm listening to you all, and I reflect on watching Simone give her testimony, and she pauses and she has her moment and she starts crying. And, you know, I apologize if this is a trigger for anyone, but, you know, I think we lose sight of how many women, girls, and I don't want to exclude boys and men, but in particular in this context, women and girls have experienced some form of abuse, molestation, because it is a very isolating experience, and so many women and girls never say a word. Right. And I'll give the quick example. I was in college. I was accepted into a summer fellowship at Johns Hopkins, and my parents dropped me off, and I said, oh, I'm going to tour the neighborhood around the campus. And so I set off by myself, and I'm walking down the street, and I see a man coming towards me, and I didn't think anything of it, and I'm walking, and he reached out and grabbed my left breast and took off running. And I just remember being so shocked that I couldn't move. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know whether to yell, scream, run. And you lose a piece of your innocence. And that's one instance that I would feel comfortable sharing on, yeah, on the air. But we talk about these failed systems and lose sight of the fact that all of these young women and so many others, their innocence is stripped, and they have to live with this every day. It never goes away. And so while this pedophile is now going to serve time, these young women are serving time with him because the scars of what he did never goes away. And so as someone who has a daughter, it is deeply concerning that as she goes out into the world, this is her lived reality, right, being a girl, being a woman in this society, because we have a failed system. It has and continues to be a system that allows perpetrators to thrive and continue to do what they've done forever. And I think this underscores the significance of the Me Too movement, because it's fundamentally shifting social and cultural norms in this country when it comes to molesting women, being abusive of women, and not, again, not just women. So, you know, I don't want to underscore the impact that this will have on the women in this case for their lifetime.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking, you make such a good point, Dorsey, because of the, I was thinking of when people were talking about Simone Biles and during the Olympics, and, you know, she was having, she said she needed a timeout for her mental health and so forth. And people were saying, oh, come on, you can do it. And I just thought, you know, what these women have been through, and they're all victims, everyone on that team. And it just, the fact that, you know, we don't even really think about and take that into consideration of what they have been through. And even the fact of just going back into competition has to be incredibly triggering, I would think, and still having to talk about it as well, which I know is important, but yet still is very hard, as you say, and I think you said it beautifully, was that yeah, they're doing time too for the rest of their life.
I just want us to think about the idea that any time any of these young women go to see a physician for the rest of their lives,
yes,
they will experience anxiety, panic attacks. They might engage in avoidance behavior to not see a physician, or a person in a position of authority who they no longer believe they can trust, right? This is true for abuse within religious institutions or any kind of well-organized structure, right? But, I mean, the anxiety, lifelong anxiety and stress, and the mechanisms you as an individual have to develop to actually function fully in society to overcome some of those constant fears. It's just a horrendous burden that we often don't reflect on to the extent that we should, I think.
Agreed. And the other thing, too, Judy, is as much as we talk about this, and I your point was not lost on me about how it was journalism that brought us the story. So, I mean, we can only extrapolate and assume that this is happening still and is happening with other people in power. And, you know, how do we suss that out as soon as possible so you don't have to have another situation like this, anything to this magnitude.
Right, and keep in mind that these were the Olympic gold medal gymnasts, you know, something we're all so proud of, but there are thousands and thousands of young women and young men who are abused every day, and they aren't getting that kind of attention, and they aren't getting that kind of that. I mean, the gymnasts were terribly hurt, but there are a lot of this happens to a lot of people, and it's easy to sweep some of those cases under the rug, and that needs to stop. And I think one of the reasons these women stepped forth yesterday, and that itself must have been very traumatic, but I think they're talking about this needs to stop for gymnasts, this needs to stop for athletes, but this needs to stop for humans, you know. And I think that's what for them made it worth going through the trauma, because I'm sure they're going to be traumatized after talking before the Senate. Can you imagine testifying before the Senate?
No.
I mean, it would be very traumatic. So, there are a lot of these cases. They don't all deal with, you know, high profile, gold, you know, Olympic gymnasts. It was incredibly horrible that this happened to such a large number of these gymnasts, but it does happen to people who of all stripes.
We'll take a break there and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Dorcia Pleers, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Judy Patrick with us. We have several letters on the subject that we were talking about right before the break, which was the testimony by several U.S. women's gymnastic team members about the sexual abuse and the botching of the case by the FBI. Anne writes to us and says, women and girls all over the world are doing time for sexual abuse for various people, in this case, the FBI, neglecting their plight, the seriousness of what they will have to live with for the rest of their lives. I myself am a sexual abuse survivor, so I know what it feels like to live every day with the memories of those experiences. The lack of acknowledgement that my and all of these girls and women's feelings matter. Why are there no consequences for the FBI? Why are none of these people being prosecuted for their negligence? Why are none of them in jail? An apology is not nearly enough. That from Anne. Susan writes, wondering how the money involved in these programs would be threatened by authorities acknowledging their traumas in real time. Dave writes, is it really surprising that the FBI remains ensconced in the culture of J. Edgar Hoover and all that he wrought? Rosemary says that the FBI needs to have interviewers trained in sexual abuse techniques. Where was Child Protective Services? New York City has an incident response team protocol that is shared with law enforcement. There are joint interviews conducted. This team of law enforcement, child protective workers, and child advocacy experts work together. This joint approach reduces trauma and could have prevented this situation. The FBI is not trained to do this type of work. Expertise is needed.
Yeah, one of the issues here was the FBI didn't even bother to refer it to someone else. Even if they didn't think they wanted to handle it, they could have at least referred it to a local authority, and they didn't do that.
Right. Got this from, I don't know. Got this from a listener who said, odd that a non-working man wants to spend time with his children. To paraphrase what Joe said, I help once a week with a religion class and coach youth soccer. My kids are part of those programs, so I believe in contributing. The statement made by Joe was way too broad. I was quoting Ali Reisman, but okay. I wish I had more time to help with the players that struggle more, because when they aren't as good as I see it as a failure as a coach. Nasser and the FBI agents who are negligent should share cells for the rest of their lives, but there are good people who believe in service. So broad a statement should make every guy predator having to prove he's innocent. We should all have a reasonable approach as parents. I think that, again, the point that Ali was making at the time in talking to young girls was that you have to ask the question of if they have a choice of going out with people their own age in their free time. This is not to say that someone who is a youth leader is bad, but to say that someone who is working with children is then wanting to spend time with children, that isn't seen as odd and something that is questioned, especially when there have already been reports. The New York Times story that I read said, you know, there was a cloud of suspicion around him for years within the Olympic Committee. So with that, hopefully somewhat of a clarification. Anybody want?
And also maybe.
Yeah.
Joe, I can just add, it's fairly standard practice that you don't spend extended periods of time by yourself.
Right.
With groups of children. You should have a collaborator, another person in the room, just in case you are protected as well as the children. So this is standard practice in educational environments. And I think it's something to think about. You know, what is the best approach to making sure that everyone is safe and well respected, and the conduct is appropriate?
Yes, and I would just say, you know, we can't let the U.S. Olympics off the hook here.
Not at all.
Oftentimes when there is a perpetrator, people know. It is not a secret. It's discussed in behind closed doors. And so the fact that he was allowed to continue to travel and be left alone with these girls, there's a lot of blame to go around, the FBI included, but also looking at the culture within that these young girls and young women, their parents, their families entrusted them with this institution, and they were very vulnerable, and someone should have been protecting them.
Absolutely. We got this from Karen, who writes, every time I see a male doctor, there is always a female aide or someone present. Why is this not done with the Olympic gymnasts? Well, I think that gets back to the question of, you know, their handling of the situation as well. Mike says, one wonders, with over 100 victims, where were the parents? Not one parent said anything? Did not one child say something to their parent? Or am I missing something? Well, I'll let the panel take on this issue, but I mean, I think one of it has to do with the culture of the Olympics and the sort of the parental giving up of their children to the Olympic Committee. But I'll let Vera, would you like to?
Yes,
go ahead, Dorsey.
Dorsey, go ahead.
I was going to say that yes, when you look at the culture of the Olympics, oftentimes these young people don't see their parents for an extended period of time. Their parents are entrusting their child with their coaches and the team, essentially the village that they spend the bulk of their time with. So that's a culturally that contributes to a part of the problem because you are away from your parents.
Right.
The other piece is, and I read this in preparation for today, that one of the young women, she said, I did not even tell my mother. I spoke to the FBI agent before sharing with my mother. And so we know often victims do not share with their parents. So this also contributed to how this played out.
I mean, that can be a very difficult thing for anyone of any age, but especially for a child to talk to their parent about something so personal.
Yeah, I would confirm that what Dorsey said, something, you know, I disclosed a while ago on air, similar to what Dorsey described happened to me as a maybe 13 or 14 year old. And I was on vacation with my parents and my family, and I never described to my parents what happened to me for the simple reason that I was so shocked and also that I somehow lacked the exact language or the words to describe how I felt or what happened to me. So I really struggled. I sort of told my younger brother what happened, but you know, he sort of looked at me and he said, oh, that's weird. And then that was it for the conversation, right?
Yeah.
And it took more than a decade before I mentioned it to anybody else. Once I had gained the language to describe what the exact feeling was, how it disturbed me. So it was extremely difficult. So if people are surprised that young women or young men don't explain to their loved ones what took place, I can sympathize because I think it's just so shameful or so disturbing that often you just don't have the appropriate language to describe, like you would as an adult, what took place.
And we hear that over and over again, whether it was the abuse in the Catholic Church of the young children and young boys who were abused in that situation, especially when you enter religion into it, and that you're telling on someone that your family respects so highly, and of course what happened in boarding schools across the country with young women. And again, you know, who do you go to if your parents aren't around? And even if they are around, what you just said, Vera, of how difficult it is.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. We have a couple more letters. I'll get to these. To me, it is not a single monster, writes Josh, but it is a sexual objectification of women by mostly men, and is a culture of men protecting men and supporting men in their abuse of women until the entire attitude of men towards women changes. You will find these examples from governmental agencies, police authorities, bosses, doctors, husbands, boyfriends, .. Florence writes, this is bigger than the FBI. We live in a patriarchal society. Women's views rarely count, even today. An investigation of the FBI is just a small part of the problem. And I think the gymnasts were so brave, writes Laura, to show up at the hearing in Congress, knowing how other women with similar experiences have been treated. You know, Anita Hill, Christine Blasey Ford, etc. The men in Congress are complicit in this. They use their platform brilliantly. I am so proud of the women. With that, It is time for us to go. My thanks to everyone this morning. Dorsey, Vera, and Judy, I thank you so much for your thoughts and for sharing with us this morning and for a really important conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be well. Thank you.